A coronavirus update.
Can aspirin prevent liver cancer?
What's the appropriate oxygen level for people who have acute respiratory distress syndrome in the ICU?
And the consequences of under-vaccination of measles.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Let us turn, of course, immediately to coronavirus, COVID-19. We do have a report that we're talking about that was published in this MedRxiv. So this is not peer-reviewed, but one of my colleagues at Johns Hopkins was one of the authors on it. And I thought this was a really relevant paper for a number of reasons. They took a look at a cohort of people who were positive for COVID-19 and were symptomatic. And then they looked at all of their contacts. They looked at how long did it take before you got symptoms? How about your household contacts? What was the so-called household secondary attack rate? That's the percentage of household contacts who were later confirmed to be infected with this particular virus. And they looked at, gosh, how many people are you likely to infect if you are already positive? Actually, they looked at an incubation period for COVID-19. Now, in this particular cohort, 4.8 days. They noted that 95% of those who develop symptoms will do so within 14 days. Of this 228 cases with known outcomes, their median recovery time is 32 days. That's really long in those who are 50 to 59 years old. They think it's shorter in those who are younger. In this cohort, only 3 people have died. These deaths occurred 35 to 44 days from symptom onset and a month on average from confirmation of infection. The secondary attack rate was about 15% for those in the household and about 10% overall. There was some indication of an elevated attack rate in older age groups. This secondary case caused by each index case was only 0.4, so half a person, if you will. And having looked at all of these infections, they found that 80% of those infections were caused by about 9% of cases. So there's not a perfect transmission among people who are infected. And finally, in this particular paper, the thing that I thought was also really important was the infection rate among children. And they found that children were as likely to be infected as other household contacts. And so they're just not so likely to be symptomatic, and they appear to get over it a little bit sooner.
In this group that you mentioned from Shenzhen, China, they examined people that had symptoms, proven coronavirus. When they used a surveillance technique instead of just waiting for symptoms, they were able to identify coronavirus about 2 days earlier than those that had symptoms. About 90% of the individuals had either very mild or moderate symptoms, and only about 10% were severe. Of those in the surveillance cohort, about 30% of the contact-based surveillance group did not have fever, and 20% had no symptoms at all.
One of the things I think that this work at least brings up to me is the idea that children could be out there carrying on just being really effective, as there are in many infectious diseases, at infecting others.
They're much more likely to have mild symptoms. But again, the infection rate was no different in the children as opposed to the older individuals.
More to come, of course. Which of your two would you like to turn to, both in the New England Journal of Medicine?
Let's talk about the measles outbreak that occurred in New York City in 2018 and 2019. Specifically, this is a report in New York City of 649 measles cases that occurred from September 30th, 2018 to July 15th of 2019. These authors investigated suspected cases of measles by conducting interviews, reviewing the medical immunization records, identifying exposed persons, and performing diagnostic testing. And then after they did all this, they estimated the total direct cost to the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. The majority of patients were of the Orthodox Jewish community, about 93%, and most of them in the Williamsburg area of Brooklyn, New York. Median age was 3 years. Of the patients with a known vaccination history, it appears that 86% of those who developed the measles were unvaccinated. Pneumonia in about 6%, hospitalization in about 8%. And of those who were hospitalized, about 41% were actually admitted to the ICU, and half of those were on a ventilator. When they looked at the cost, about 7% of the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene in New York City, that is 559 staff members, were involved in this response, and it cost the city $8.4 million. That doesn't even include the hospitalization and medical cost as well. What caused this? A large number of people in this particular community that were unvaccinated, and that was because an anti-vaccination group had targeted this area in the decade before.
Not a benign condition. This is not a good thing to get your kids infected with.
The complication rate is significant. The complication rate of measles in vaccinated children is less than 0.0001%. As a result of this significant outbreak, New York City mandated that schools and child care centers, where many of the infections were transmitted, could not admit kids that weren't vaccinated. If they did so, they were fined or they were closed.
Yeah, you really, I think, have to put some teeth into it. And one of my reasons for picking this study this week was because, of course, everyone is working really hard to develop a vaccine against the COVID-19. And if we have resistance against immunization, this is going to be a persistent problem.
Vaccinations only work if the children receive them.
Let's turn to something else that's, of course, related and also in the New England Journal of Medicine. This is a look at what is the appropriate level of oxygenation to try to target if somebody is admitted to the intensive care unit with acute respiratory distress syndrome or ARDS. This is called liberal or conservative oxygen therapy when people have that, and it was a study that was conducted in France. There's been a lot of conversation about the proper management of people when they're in the ICU. We've talked before about blood sugar levels that are appropriate, and in this case, the question is, if we give them too much oxygen, are we creating free radicals that end up causing tissue damage, and that in the long haul is not a terribly good thing. So in this study, they were taking a look at the partial pressure of oxygen that they wanted to target, the saturation, as measured by pulse oximetry. In the conservative strategy, they were looking at 55 to 70 millimeters of mercury, or in the liberal one, it was 90 to 105 millimeters of mercury. They had a total of 205 patients. They did stop this trial prematurely. And the reason that they did that is because it was unlikely by the trajectory of everybody who was enrolled up until that point that the conservative therapy was really going to be very helpful. It did not result in better outcomes. And they did have five cases of what is called mesenteric ischemic events that occurred in this conservative oxygen group. This, unfortunately, again, in light of COVID, is becoming an issue. How do we best manage these folks? And that was one of the reasons I picked this. I'm happy to see that it's being addressed. And maybe this is something that suggests that somewhere in that there's a sweet spot that's in the middle, not too much oxygen, but not a conservative strategy either.
In people admitted with a myocardial infarction or heart attack, it's been shown that administering oxygen when the patients don't need it, i.e. they're not hypoxic, actually increases mortality. So there's some rationale behind not giving too much oxygen. They targeted an arterial saturation. An oxygen saturation is measured by pulse oximetry in the liberal oxygen therapy group of 96%, and in the more conservative between 88 to 92%. The more conservative oxygen therapy was not beneficial, in fact, was probably harmful.
The editorialist talks about oxygen titration is really an imperfect science, that pulse oximetry, of course, is not really great at determining exactly what is going on.
Right. Ideally, what you'd like to have is a monitor inside someone's arterial blood that monitors things continuously and is accurate. Unfortunately, we don't have that.
Right. A case where more is not better. Let's turn finally to your last one. And that's, as I said, still in the New England Journal of Medicine. And this is a look at aspirin and liver cancer and liver-related mortality.
We will call it by its proper name, hepatocellular carcinoma or liver cancer. And there are more than 500,000 cases diagnosed each year, primarily related to infection with hepatitis B or hepatitis C virus. And actually, over the last several decades, the mortality from liver cancer is increasing faster than any other type of cancer. We know that you can reduce the risk of liver cancer in people that have those infections either by suppressing hepatitis B virus or by eradicating hepatitis C with some of the newer medications. But even in those patients, they still have an increased risk of hepatocellular or liver cancer. Can low-dose aspirin prevent liver cancer and liver cancer mortality in individuals that have hepatitis B or C infection? And to address that, these investigators used the nationwide Swedish registries. They looked at all adults who had a diagnosis of chronic hepatitis B or C infection between 2005 and 2015. There were over 50,000 such patients. Of these, about 14,000 had aspirin prescriptions filled. And interestingly, in Sweden, you don't get aspirin over the counter. The vast majority of individuals get it by prescription. So they're able to follow these individuals. And what they determined is over an 8-year time period, the individuals that had low-dose aspirin use had about a 30% reduction in hepatocellular carcinoma and about a 27% reduction in liver cancer-related deaths. Low-dose aspirin use for the first 3 years didn't significantly reduce liver cancer, but use over 3 years, and particularly over 5 years, significantly reduced it. Now you say, well, what's the risk? But in this cohort of individuals, those that took low-dose aspirin did not have a significantly increased risk of bleeding compared to those that did not receive aspirin at all.
What was the average age of these folks?
The average age was about 50. For those that did not use aspirin, the average age is about 40.
Clearly, the reason that I'm asking about their age is because we know that that bleeding risk, that GI bleed risk, increases with age.
Right. But these individuals oftentimes develop hepatocellular carcinoma and have liver-related deaths at very young ages. 10-year liver-related mortality was 11% among those that used aspirin and 18% among those who did not.
You said that you felt that there was some biological plausibility here, and how do you account for that?
Well, Elizabeth, the most likely explanation is that the cyclooxygenase 2, that is pro-inflammatory chemicals, are markedly reduced in people that take aspirin.
And so, based on this, would you say that people who have hepatitis B or hepatitis C and are at risk, therefore, of developing liver cancer ought to be on low-dose aspirin?
Based upon this data, I would recommend low-dose aspirin in such patients.
On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.